Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hopp, and today's special guest is Phil Lempert. He's the supermarket guru. You can see him on TV as a frequent denizen of the morning shows, and he's also interviewed throughout the media. And we're talking about trends in the supermarket industry and the food industry in general for 2016. And in part one, Phil, you identified 2016 as a real breakthrough year. What do you see coming down the pike?
Well, if you take a look at stores, and let's start with the stores themselves. We've seen a lot of stores, including the great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, A&P, go out of business. We're seeing stores reduce in size, going down to about 15,000 square foot. The average supermarket now is about 50,000 square foot, has about 40,000 products in it. So just imagine a store that has about a third of the products in it. And we're seeing hugely successful companies like Aldi, for example, from Germany. That's the sister company or parent company, if you would, to Trader Joe's. They now already have over 1,600 locations in the U.S. It's expected that they'll have about 5,000 locations over the next few years. These stores are 15,000 square foot. They have about 90% of what their goods are under their own store brand versus a national brand. And probably the most important thing, and one of the reasons that millennials just love Aldi's, it's about a third less expensive, and their quality is fabulous. So we're seeing a lot of what we call micro stores.
That's all, sort of a la Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's has sort of established that model with their own house brands to natural, to sort of quasi-natural food, but with the bargains, you know, sometimes loss leaders to bring people into the store.
And not only loss leaders, but Trader Joe's model, which has been hugely successful, is they might have a product that really sells well, and then they pull it off the market for 3 months. Just to get us to try other things, and then they bring it back. Very intelligent marketing and merchandising. We're seeing Green Zebra in Portland, for example, 5,000 square foot stores. Be Fresh in Boston. We're seeing a lot of these retailers also becoming more important to us as consumers and being on our side. For example, Aldi announced their decision, probably about 3 months ago, to remove certified synthetic colors, partially hydrogenated oils, and MSG from all of its own brands by the end of last year. We saw an announcement from Aldi removing all sugary snacks and candies from their checkout lanes. So we're really seeing these retailers becoming more curators, if you would, rather than just loading their shelves with anything that is imaginable. They want to pick and choose. They want to be part of our decision process in whether it's healthier, whether it's more indulgent, those kinds of things, which, again, tie in perfectly with millennials and Generation Z, who today are becoming much more involved in delivery, whether it's through Instacart, whether it's Fresh Direct. This generation doesn't want to even go into a store.
Right.
So if a store wants to stay in business, they've got to change dramatically. And that's what we're seeing with stores led by Aldi. Lidl from Germany is coming over. They already built a warehouse, a distribution center in Virginia. They're going to have a couple thousand stores. So, you know, in a very short order, the idea of a supermarket, what it looks like, is going to be different. And we're going to have much more of a balance between what we get delivered and what we go into a store to buy.
You know, I think you're really right about that because, to my amazement, the other day I went to sometimes I'll stop off at the supermarket instead of the health food store, and I stopped off at the supermarket, and it looked like, you know, like an apocalyptic scene. You know, everything was overturned, the shelves were empty. You know, kind of like those movies. You know, after the zombie attack, and it had closed. It had closed big supermarket space. And all these little, smaller, more nimble outfits are opening up, very much European style. This kind of reminds me of, you know, a few years back when we went to Europe, and I would look at, you know, these beautiful little stores in German cities. you know, really high-end goods, natural, you know, emphasis on, you know, beautiful display and lighting. And that's what we're seeing more and more of here in New York, probably also in Santa Monica.
And throughout the entire country. It's growing in Chicago, for example, where Aldi is headquartered. I don't remember the exact number, but it's something like 150 Aldis right in the Chicago area. And probably one of the most important aspects, and my favorite produce department I'll use as an example, it's actually in Milan, Italy. We have a produce department with about 500 different items in it, but typically we as consumers buy the same 10 products all the time. So it's a nice display. It sets the stage with beautiful colors and aromas. Well, in Italy, there was a counter that was probably about 20 foot long. And on top of the counter was an assortment of produce items, probably about 40 different items. But you didn't see these big bushels or big displays. You might see, you know, a dozen bananas, but every banana was perfect. And there were
curated
people,
bananas.
Exactly. There were two people behind the counter. So if I went over and I bought three bananas, someone would go in the back and pick another three beautiful bananas and put it out there. And I looked at that. And the first time I saw it was probably about 10 years ago in this store. And I've been back and seen it probably six times since. And it's not changed. It just made it more palatable. Rather than going into a huge produce department with all this overwhelm, I mean, do we really need, you know, 20 different varieties of apples, all of which have been in cold storage for about a year, matter of fact, before it even gets to our store? Do we need that? No, maybe we need two different kinds of apples that are really tasty and in season and fresh.
Well, you know, Phil, you and I are roughly contemporaries, and I remember when you know, as a kid, the trend was to put everything under plastic wrap, you know, in one of those like green or black containers, even, you know, fruit. It was pretty unappetizing. And the fresh fruit section, especially kind of, in, you know, maybe in the cities it was better, but in the hinterland, you know, in suburbia, they, you just couldn't find fresh produce. And boy, that has turned around big time, hasn't it?
It has, and I think we're going to see it evolve even more. As you mentioned before, local has become probably the biggest trend that we've seen in supermarkets in two decades. But now we have to understand that local is not sustainable. So if you're in certain parts of the country, California is a great example. You know, there's a lot of fruits and vegetables that are local, but you go into the middle of the country, not so much, especially in winter. So the two things that we're seeing are people returning back to eating what's in season. And the reason for that is 3 points. Number one, it's less expensive. If you don't have to fly in blueberries from Chile or someplace else, it's going to cost less. Number two, it's on the vine or on the tree or in the ground longer, which means it's going to have more nutrients to it. And number three, and probably most important, it's going to taste better. Again, because it was fresher, it's on the vine longer, and it's in season. So we're starting to see it move away from local and into what we call bioregions. And that basically means that there are certain parts of the country and the world where certain crops grow better because of the soil, because of the climate, a whole variety of factors taking place. For example, coffee. If I offered you, you know, coffee, the beans grown in Santa Monica, they're not going to be nearly as tasty as those in Colombia. So we're starting to see that more with produce happening around the country. And also when you look at California, which supplies half of the produce and is now in drought, we're seeing a lot of produce either go through the roof in cost or have limited suppliers. And we're also seeing California farmers moving to Peru or moving to Georgia or moving to other parts of the world for the price of water, because it's just not affordable here in California. We're also seeing a lot more appliances like the Urban Cultivator and Grove, which are basically about the size of a dishwasher that you can put in your own kitchen, connected to water, connected to electric. And these are growing stations where you can grow, you know, your own lettuces, your own kale, all kinds of produce items right in your own kitchen. So you don't need pesticides. You don't need to worry about the cost. And everything is just automatic right there.
Well, now that they have marijuana dispensaries in California, you don't need to use all the electricity and water to grow a pot. You can harness that to growing your own food. Sounds good.
Exactly.
So there's a whole brouhaha now about counterfeit foods, and you probably are aware that 60 Minutes had a big expose on counterfeit olive oil. I think you've probably been on this issue for a long time before that. What's the deal? You know, there's also issues with salmon that's a farmed salmon that's being palmed off as wild salmon. There's a big price disparity. There's instances of Chilean sea bass, which is actually, South Atlantic tusk fish or something like that, some poor substitute for that. So how are we combating how can a consumer be wary of the potential for that?
Well, there's two type of counterfeit foods. One, which is the major problem that the industry faces, is that there are many thousands of food factories in China. And basically what they'll do is they'll come over here, they'll buy product, they will bring it back, they will, you know, create the same exact package, if you would. This has also been going on with cigarettes for a long time.
And so that's a real counterfeit. That's like a Fendi, a Fendi bag that they sell on the street corner here in New York in front of Saks. It's really a counterfeit. Yeah.
Exactly. Where you'll get, you know, fake M&Ms and fake Campbell's soup and fake everything. And we frankly won't know it. That's number one. And again, part of the reason for that is we just don't have enough food inspectors on the docks throughout the country to monitor these shipments coming in. So that's number one. Number two, and you bring up very correctly, the idea that whether it's restaurants or supermarkets are mislabeling products for added profit. Again, the problem is that we don't have enough inspectors to be able to have a check and balance on the system. So when it comes to seafood in particular, there's a couple tools that you should look at. Number one is if it sounds too good to be true, it probably isn't. Yeah. So, for example, Whole Foods, and we came down on them probably about, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, was selling organic wild salmon. Well, there is no such thing as organic
that's
seafood.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah.
So, and they were selling it for $27 a pound, just to give you some idea.
Yeah.
The key to salmon in particular is look at the little letters on the package or on, if you're buying it from the fresh department, on the little sign. And if it says color added, even natural color added, you will know that that's not wild.
It's farmed.
It's farmed.
Yeah. And the coloring is actually astaxanthin, which is a popular nutritional supplement these days that they got to give to the farm fish. Otherwise, the flesh would be gray, I understand.
Exactly. And also, I urge everybody, and this is a free app, to download from Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. There are over 5,000 different species of seafood, and there's very little differences in some. So, you know, there are restaurants that are replacing flounder with tilapia. And for the most part, once it's cooked, very few of us can actually tell the difference.
Wow.
So you want to look at those labels, and my recommendation, both to save money and to know what you're getting when it comes to seafood, is go to the frozen department, not the fresh seafood counter. When you think about how fish are caught, a boat goes out for weeks at a time, catches the fish, and most of the time actually processes it and packages it right on the boat.
So it's like a factory. It's a factory ship.
It's a fact. Yeah, exactly. So that by the time it gets to land and it goes to a distributor, what a distributor does for fresh seafood, basically thaws it out, sells it to the supermarket, And then the supermarket puts it on ice again, which is basically refreezing it. So you've had it, you know, fresh, then frozen, then defrosted, then frozen again. But again, by law, you have to have the words previously frozen on whether it's that label or that little tag that's in that seafood case. So always look there. You'll save about 40% and, in my opinion, get a better quality piece of fish if you head right to the frozen seafood department, where you can see what country it's coming from right now until the packaging is used up. But you're still going to see a lot of companies continue country of origin labeling, even though it's not mandated. And also,
it's voluntary. Exactly, in other words, they want to strut their stuff. They want to declare that it is from a place that is associated with a good reputation.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at China, for example, I will never buy seafood from China. And one of the reasons the seafood farms, and I know this is going to sound tacky, for lack of a better word, but the seafood farms basically have chicken coops hanging over them, and the way the fish are fed is the poop from the chickens, because that's rich in protein, and it grows the fish faster.
Very ingenious.
So, you know,
that's very
again,
ingenious.
Seafood
yes.
Watch from yeah, it is. It is. Still don't want to eat it, but it is genius. But that's why, you know, having an app like Seafood Watch from Monterey Bay Aquarium, nonprofit, can tell you what is safe from a food safety standpoint, what is endangered as a seafood species, what's good, what's bad when it comes to seafood.
What about olive oil? Olive oil has been the subject of an expose recently on 60 Minutes. What's the deal? Yeah. They're telling us that a very high percentage of the olive oil that purports to be extra virgin olive oil isn't up to snuff.
Yeah, you know, it's the International Olive Oil Council that sets the regulation. And basically what the regulation is you have to have acidity of 1% or less to be called extra virgin olive oil. The problem with olive oil goes well beyond whether it's extra virgin or not. If next time you go into a supermarket, look at the labels carefully. And even the brands that have Italian names to them, typically the olive oil is coming from Tunisia or Spain because it's less expensive. And olive oil, for the most part, like the oil or gasoline that we put in our cars, you know, are not made by a bunch of little old Italian women with their shoes off crushing olives. It is in refineries, if you would, with these big stainless steel tanks. So you want to be careful. There are a lot of great olive oil brands that are out there, especially now from California and France, that have on it not only certification that their olive oil has been tested to be, whether it's extra virgin or where it's coming from, but also are more reserved, that it's coming from an individual farm where the olives are being grown, that it's not just olive oil that's been tanked from different countries and brought to a refinery and then mixed. Olive oil has always been very, very controversial because the standards aren't great. And the Italian government, matter of fact, has gone out of its way to confuse people so that what we have is every bottle of olive oil that comes to this country that's exported from Italy has a dollar given back to that company by the Italian government to promote export. So that's why, you know, you'll take olive oil that is done in Spain, grown in Spain, processed in Spain, and it is then tanked to Italy. Usually it's Lucca, Italy, where it's packaged. So it'll say packed in Lucca. Now, I've been to Lucca, and Lucca is a walled city, and there are no olive oil, you know, active olive oil presses, except maybe if somebody has it at home, in Lucca. So they actually had to change the regulation. So to say packed in Lucca, it could be in Lucca County. Lucca County didn't exist, you know, 100 years ago. There was just Lucca, but they had to make it Lucca County so there was more space for packaging, quote-unquote, Italian olive oil.
But it didn't come from a medieval mountain village. It came from a modern refinery on the outskirts of Lucca.
Exactly, which is why, you know, look at those labels carefully and see, you know, if it says hand-pressed, especially if it's a U.S. company, and there's a lot of great olive oil coming out of California these days.
Yep.
The laws are different than that for imports.
Argentina, too. New Zealand, even, I think, has
yes.
an olive oil industry where, you know, good quality control, and sometimes it's not all about Italy. Yeah.
Yep.
One other issue on the food front is shrimp. And not to mention the potential toxicity of shrimp that's grown in unsanitary conditions, but there's kind of an ethical issue around shrimp because of an expose that shrimp grown in Indochina is sometimes produced with slave labor. Are you familiar with that issue?
Yes. You know, most food around the world, and even here in the U.S., I would argue, is produced by slave labor.
Yeah.
You know, if we look at the big $15
literally or figuratively,
hour,
right?
Yeah. If we look at the $15 an hour minimum wage, let's remember that people who are working in McDonald's that are handling our foods are at minimum wage, oftentimes around $10, and they don't have health care. And one of the problems that we've got with food safety issues is that these people, when they're sick, cannot take off. They just can't afford to. So they're going to work with coughing, with sneezing, with whatever kind of colds that they might have, and they're coughing on our food and so on. So I would also call that slave labor to a degree. And you know, we're now starting to see not only, you know, the $15 minimum wage, which is going to have huge effects on retail. I mean, one of the reasons that Walmart is closing about 150
direct
stores
response
in the U.S.
to that. Yes.
Yep. Is they're just saying we can't afford, you know, the labor. So we're really in a pickle because a lot of these families aren't making enough money. But yet, if they make enough money, the companies that are paying them can't afford to stay in business. So there's that dilemma, you know, going on. But, you know, even if you look in certain countries, whether it's shrimp farming or coffee or cocoa
chocolate beans and so on.
You've got these people, and again, their pay scale is very different than ours, but you've got these people who are working for, you know, $20 a month. Now, that doesn't mean when we hear those numbers that they are destitute.
Yeah.
$20 a month in certain countries, you know, is a good middle class job.
Well, it's like, a little like the issue of blood diamonds. You know, you have to kind of trace the provenance of things that you like to subsidize, because otherwise you may be subsidizing, you know, a local warlord who puts together press gangs to harvest crops.
Exactly. And you know, we saw it last year with limes. The price of limes went through the roof in this country. And the reason it went through the roof was not about citrus greening or anything else. It's the fact that basically in Mexico, the major lime farm operation was taken over by the drug cartel.
Wow.
And they, you know, did their thing for supply and demand. And basically, they raised the price tenfold of limes. It's come back since. But we're going to see more and more of this, which is also one of the reasons that in the past year, we've seen over $500 billion put into food from Silicon Valley. Now, that's everything from coming up with new kinds of foods that are healthier, new proteins that are not animal-based, new supply chain management, new delivery systems. So one of the reasons that I said early on that we're seeing bigger changes in our food supply than ever before is we're not now having, you know, second, third, fourth generation of food industry running food. We're now seeing this whole new Silicon Valley mentality and money coming into food and coming into agriculture that's going to change everything.
Creative disruption.
Creative disruption.
Yep.
And frankly, bringing a lot of new things. One of the hottest new products that I see for 2016 is algae. And we're seeing algae in just about every product. And the whole world started because of algae, very nutritious. And there's a new oil on the market, algae oil, called Thrive, matter of fact, which is 75% less saturated fat than olive oil, has a higher flash point. Nothing added to it. It's just algae oil. And we're going to see more and more products. And that comes out of Silicon Valley because of biofuel. Where this company,
I was going to say, put it in your gas tank and run your car?
Well, no, I don't think you can with this product. But what this company started out was
something else they're making was designed for that. Yeah.
But with the price of oil going, they were doing great when oil was over $100 a barrel. But now while it's $30 a barrel, that whole biofuel market dropped out and they've switched and they're now in the food business.
Oh, indeed. I've heard that milk is cheaper than gasoline these days, so there is really a sea change on that. Well, you are really a fount of knowledge on the food front. And so what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? You've got a great website at supermarketguru.com. What will listeners find if they go there?
Well, we do a new trend video every day. So there's 5 new videos a week put up. We also do product reviews, 5 videos, 5 new product reviews. And we rate the products based on 9 different attributes. Certainly health is one of them. Taste is the most important. Price. And just focused on the issues that supermarkets and consumers and brands need to be aware of that goes beyond the headlines, such as we talked about with Campbell Soup, talking about GMO labels. Yes, it's a real interesting story, and what they're doing is good but not great, but their break from the industry is what's the most important thing to be watching.
Okay, so you can go to supermarketguru.com and subscribe to the Limpert Report, get all your food information delivered to your mobile device or to your desktop. It's great information, as always. Thank you so much, Phil Limpert, for joining us, and all the best to you.
Thank you, Ron.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.